ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Tammy Shipley believed someone was out to hurt her.
I thought someone was after me and I wanted to just be safe.
She's put under 24-hour surveillance.
I tried to get in contact multiple times.
I'm going to make a phone call. Nobody knows where I am.
And then something strange happens.
She just drank and drank and had something like 20 litres of pure water.
Ambulance emergency.
I've got a woman unconscious.
Tammy's story. Search Background Briefing on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
This podcast was produced on the lands of the Awabakal and Gadigal people. G'day, Matt Bevan here. This is If You're Listening. We've just finished our four-part series on Taiwan, and while researching this series, Adair Shepherd, who helped me write the series, stumbled across an incredible piece of reporting, one that showed truly extraordinary commitment to the craft from ABC foreign correspondent Eric Campbell.
I'm going to regret this. It rather hurts. I think probably 2.5 kilos is my limit at this early stage. No, please.
Unfortunately, we never found a place for this remarkable piece of television in our series on Taiwan, so we've decided that it deserves an episode all of its own. It's too good to just file away. But just a warning, it does touch on some adult themes in case you're listening with some small ears around. This is just one example of the many unusual situations Eric Campbell found himself in during nearly three decades as an ABC foreign correspondent. He's also about to head back to Taiwan for a story for Al Jazeera, so we thought it was the perfect time to catch up with him. Eric, hello.
Hello, Matt, and thank you for that. I think it's my finest work.
So, Eric, this story that you did in 2005, it's titled Taiwan Pulling Power. Without giving too much away, what can you tell us about how you came across it and why you started looking into the practice of Yin Diao Gang?
Well, I suppose good investigative journalism, we were going to do a story about the President Chen Shui-bian, and in those days the Foreign Correspondent Program also had postcards, little five-minute stories about some quirky thing. So I Googled Taiwan Weird and Taiwan Bizarre. And basically, it's an ancient Chinese art form called Yin Diao Gong.
Tu Xin Sheng is the Grand Master of Yin Diao Gong, an extraordinary and controversial form of medicine for men who want to be all they can be.
So basically, you tie a rope around what you might call the beans and the franc and tighten it. And then with a hook on the end of the rope that's attached to you, you lift weights. And the more you lift, the stronger you become, the stronger your chi is, and according to the proponents, the stronger your potency becomes. And they describe it as a form of lifelong Viagra.
Master Tu believes conventional medicine will one day recognise the benefits of this exercise and even see it as a safe alternative to potency-enhancing drugs like Viagra.
I should say that there is a link to the video of Eric's report in our show notes today. We will do our best to describe it if you are stuck in the car and you can't watch that link right now, but it's there for when you get to your destination.
I think every man can imagine it.
To be honest, Eric, Adair told me about this story, and it wasn't until I watched it that I truly understood.
After deep breathing, each man ties a soft sash around his penis and scrotum and straps on a 5 kilogram weight.
I don't really know how to describe it myself. These gentlemen are wearing martial arts outfits, sort of the sort of outfit that you might wear in Taekwondo, but it's very much open at the groin area. And they have a sash, and then there's a hook on that sash. And what are they attaching to that hook?
Anything. They claim they've pulled planes, a jumbo plane. In this instance, they're pulling a car.
The more experienced practitioners are still to discover the limits of Yin Diao Gong. As their chi grows, so do their feats of strength. One man even offering to pull our van.
They're attaching the sash to a car and they're pulling it along.
Yes, our van with all our gear in it, with about 100 kilograms of camera gear.
Oh, is that your car?
Yes, it was, yes.
Okay.
I think the limit that I saw is 200 kilograms, which even today makes my eyes water.
Even the older practitioners can perform extraordinary acts of strength, lifting as much as 200 kilograms in weight.
What was it like pitching this story to the other people at Foreign Correspondent?
Look, as a very serious program, that they hesitated for at least a quarter of a second before enthusiastically saying, do it, you know.
Did any of the producers say, Eric, if you're going to go and do this story, then you're going to have to personally try it?
Reporter involvement is a cheesy old meme from way back in the early days of John Logie Baird. When you're doing this sort of thing, this, you do have to watch the reporter suffer.
And so, at Master Tu's urging, I was initiated into the ancient world of Yin Jiao Gong.
So, what do I do with this? Yeah, so that's like that, then that goes through. Oh, do I need the, thick one, do I? Why am I doing this? Jeff, we might do this. Can you just wait in the other room for a minute?
So you've sent the cameraman out of the room to attach the sash. You were attaching it yourself, right?
Actually, to be honest, I had to call for assistance. if you're doing a story, no matter what it is, you have to do it to your fullest, and this was no exception. So I had to endure that indignity as well.
How were you feeling at this stage where you saw them beginning to tie it to the hook?
I was thinking this is probably a very bad idea, but once you're in there and you've got the TA, you know, the per diems for the shoot and everything, you can't really back out. So I didn't anticipate I'd be spending the next 12 hours lying in the fetal position in the hotel room.
Oh, well, I was going to ask about that, but yeah.
But I still hold the Australian record.
let's watch you achieve that record.
You give me the weight. Thank you. I can't feel any immediate health benefits. It's very much as you'd imagine it would be. It rather hurts. I think probably 2.5 kilos is my limit at this early stage. I think I need more training. More.
Was he offering to give it a tug, or was he offering to put more weight on?
Offering more weight, yes, and I was happy. But then the extraordinary thing is that they offered to lift me up.
But remember, these men are highly trained. Don't try this at home.
The camera cuts to you sitting on sort of a little platform, sort of in the fetal position already, which I imagine is the position that you were wanting to be in, and sitting on the platform, which is attached to like sort of a metal bracket, and then hooked onto the sash dangling between the legs of a man who is standing on two blocks so that he is above your head.
You paint a very good visual picture.
It's one that I will never be able to forget, I think, Gary.
Don't look up.
It's the swinging back and forward.
Thank you for re-traumatising me.
Was there some sort of a risk assessment process that you went through for this, Eric?
These were happier, simpler times when the words OH&S, you know, and health and safety never reared themselves in the ABC. So I couldn't do it now. Absolutely not, no.
So you mentioned that there was ongoing negative effects over the next 12 hours?
Yes, there were, and then I was fired by next morning. The health benefits didn't really come.
Yes, I imagine so.
But the trauma remains.
There was a bit where you said that the practitioner insists that this is an ancient art.
Mm.
In his school in downtown Taipei, devotees limber up for what he insists is an ancient art, almost lost in the mists of time.
Is there much evidence of Yin Dao Gong existing outside of this gentleman's imagination?
I couldn't find any. No, there was nothing. But I don't think he had any motive to lie. I think, you know, Taiwan has preserved a lot of Chinese culture that was lost in the Cultural Revolution. And this may, in fact, be one of them.
Eric, thank you for taking us through that. I do want to talk about more serious things and your long-time work reporting on the frozen conflict between China and Taiwan.
Mm.
You were a correspondent in Beijing from 2001 to 2003. What was it like reporting in China compared to reporting in Taiwan?
It was like being in prison. In China, normally as a correspondent, you have all these privileges that tourists don't have. In China, it's the opposite. A tourist can go anywhere. A tourist can go to Tibet if they wish on a package tour. They can book online. Journalists can't. We can't do anything. We couldn't leave Beijing to report without being accompanied by the Weiban, which is the foreign ministry. They'd send a miner whose job, and you'd have to pay him to do it was to bugger up your story, stop you speaking to anybody, stop you doing anything interesting, stop you meeting anybody. And the only way you could get around that was to feed him so full of food and give him so much beer that he'd pass out in the hotel, and you'd sneak out at night and try and shoot the real story. It was horrible.
Have you been to China as a tourist?
No, I went. The last time I went back was just before the Olympics, where I managed to film a protest. You think that's, you know, nothing too special, but all the years I was in China, despite massive protests going on every day, we couldn't film them. We were so leashed by the authorities. You'll find the roads are blocked. You get your camera out, your hands are over the camera. It's almost impossible. And for years, there was no actual clear footage of a protest in China, just a few sort of long images that's, you know, one of the protesters had taken that they managed to smuggle out. And during the Olympics, they had to briefly loosen the restrictions to meet their commitments to the IOC. So we were able to do a few things we couldn't do normally. But China kept a very good kind of lid on the reality of the unrest that was going on and is still going on.
That's also, of course, something that Taiwan did for many, many years.
Yes.
The Republic of China did under the military dictatorship there and under martial law. I've been watching in the ABC archive, there's a report by John Temple went there in the early 80s. And likewise, there is a government official following him around everywhere, getting in the way of all of his stuff and really annoying him.
An amiable but insistent government official accompanying a foreign film crew every step of the way makes it unlikely that anyone will express an anti-government view.
When you were there in Taiwan in 2005 and around that time, I imagine it was very, very different.
Oh, it was completely different. I mean, Chiang Kai-shek, the nationalist leader, was as ruthless as any of the communists in repression, possibly even more so if you look at the massacres that took place in Taiwan. And the extraordinary shift that came after Li Dongwei introduced democracy, despite all the warnings that China could never embrace democracy, it's not in the Chinese character, and it just exploded and they loved it, you know, which rather puts the lie to, you know, China's insistence on the need for a one-party state under the wise leadership of the Chinese Communist Party. It's totally free now. It's bureaucratic. It's incredibly bureaucratic. I call it the last outpost of Soviet central planning to get anything done or to speak to a minister's office or anything. But, you know, they do talk to you. You can move around freely. You don't need permission. And people will criticize the government. The hardest thing I found when I was in China was finding people who would come on camera and criticize the Communist Party because, to a certain extent, they're so patriotic, they felt it was criticizing China to a big-nosed foreigner, hairy barbarian. So it was hard. But Taiwan, as one diplomat said to me once, they're just like us being in Australia.
The passion that they have about everything that they fight about, you know, the physicality of their fights.
Big political drama in Taiwan's legislature today, we've seen pushing, shoving, people climbing over desks and chairs. We've even seen one female lawmaker tackled to the ground.
Which I believe at some point was something that Taiwan was a bit embarrassed about, made them look like an inexperienced and immature democracy.
Ah, the punters loved it.
And it shows the passion that they have, you know, that it shows that they really care.
It is a bit like West Berlin was in the days of the Cold War, you know, surrounded by these hostile powers, even though there wasn't a feeling that war was imminent. It gave a certain kind of extremity to the place. And there's fabulous art and music and literature that's coming out of Taiwan that I think is largely a product of all these sort of, not just the freedoms, but also the pressures, the intensity of the environment, the reality of what's at stake.
That's fantastic. Speaking of the intimidation of the Chinese authorities, you last year had an encounter with a helicopter.
Yes, yes. You can always trust the Chinese Communist Party's stupidity to make good television out of an otherwise dull story. And on this occasion, we were looking at the geopolitics of the South China Sea when a PLA helicopter tried to kill us.
Right now we're being shadowed by a Chinese helicopter, which no one was expecting. The pilots reckon it is too close for safety, but this is all about brinkmanship.
Without warning, the helicopter comes frighteningly close, passing within 3 metres of our plane.
You are violating China's terror airspace. Leave now. Leave immediately.
Talking about the South China Sea, China claims it owns 90% of it, but it's, you know, contested by 6 different countries, including the Philippines. And China has claimed Filipino islands or Filipino underwater reefs. I mean, a lot of it is about rocks you can't even see. And one of the big ones is Scarborough Shoal, which had been a very important fishing ground for Filipino soldiers. China occupied it, claimed it was sovereign Chinese territory, and every now and again the Philippines flies a light plane over it just to challenge China's exclusion zone. We went out with it expecting the usual warnings, you know, the China radios, you are violating Chinese airspace, leave now, leave immediately. The Taiwanese pilot, radios back, this is our territory, you have no authority to be here. What we weren't expecting was a bloody great PLA helicopter to come flying at us, and it came within 3 metres of this little Cessna, and the downdraft alone could have sent us crashing to Scarborough Shoal. It was extraordinary.
It is a stunningly dangerous manoeuvre. We are flying at just 700 feet, and a collision would see both aircraft crash.
China's military helicopter, you are flying too close.
As if to show this was no mistake, the helicopter moves in again, coming to within 10 metres. For nearly an hour, they fly alongside us and sometimes above us until we leave the shoal. By the time we return to Manila, this close encounter has become an international incident.
Crikey! They nearly landed on top of you. They were right there.
That was something of a lose your shorts moment. Yeah, and nobody was expecting it. The pilot wasn't expecting it. Nothing like that had happened before. Just shows how China's escalating what is known as its grey zone activities. These are sort of aggressive, hostile acts that fall short of war. But what the Philippines has said is that if anybody dies as a result of these grey zone activities, they will invoke the Mutual Defence Treaty with the United States. So had we gone down, technically it could have been grounds for a war, which I wasn't really expecting on that morning jaunt over Scarborough Shoal.
It just seems terrifying. You've had one very uncomfortable and one very terrifying experience involving China that we're talking about today.
But look, I think what it does show is that while China is not, you know, trying to avoid war, it can easily stumble into it. The grey zone activities, it can get out of control. I mean, they had a sort of melee, I think the year before last, where they attacked Filipino Marines with knives and a Marine lost his thumb. I mean, it could so easily result in a death, and China just seems reckless about this.
I mean, I suppose the thing is that you've got the Philippines issuing that threat that we'll activate our mutual defence treaty with the United States. This will lead to, you know, global conflict.
If Trump decided to follow through, but that's probably what's changed now. That's the fact that, you know, people, China does not fear the US in the way it used to.
No, it's obvious now that any declarations of red lines when it comes from the US is fictional, essentially. They'll decide when the red line is crossed if they meant it or not. And when it comes to Taiwan itself, the question has always deliberately been hanging over Taiwan's head about whether the United States would come to its aid or not. Since the age of Kissinger, they've sort of gone, well, you don't know. You never know. We might yep. not, but don't test us. And yet, you know, we're still in a situation where Taiwan is de facto independent. They're able to do their own thing, and China doesn't seem to be on the brink of an invasion. So what do you make of that? We have no idea what the US would do, and China doesn't seem keen at the moment to provoke some sort of a conflict.
That's what I'm going to Taiwan for in a couple of days to find out, because I think what's interesting is, A, the fact that Trump, you know, after his tongue bath he gave to Xi Jinping in Beijing recently, and his willingness to bargain about supplying weapons to Taiwan in return for trade deals with China, has given the impression that the strategic ambiguity you mentioned isn't that ambiguous anymore. That the answer's probably no. Plus the fact that, you know, the US has lost so many missiles in Iran that it's not really in the same sort of strategic position as it was even if it wanted to defend Taiwan. And the closure of the Strait of Hormuz has shown how effective a maritime blockade can be. So you put those three things together and it does create a certain level of anxiety in Taiwan. Even if they're confident the status quo will continue, they're also busily trying to build up their drone capacity, their asymmetric war capacity. They've seen what happens in Ukraine when a big power attacks a small power. They've seen the end of the rules-based global order, if you want to call it that. My feeling is that they're not alarmed, but very, very alert at the moment.
I mean, the interesting thing for me is the closure of the Strait of Hormuz obviously shows, you know, that Taiwan is vulnerable to a blockade. But it also shows that China is vulnerable to a blockade. You don't need to cut off too much oil supply before they start drawing down their strategic reserves and they start making adjustments to their global geopolitical stances on various countries.
Mm.
They're not immune from the disruption caused by fairly minor adjustments to the global supply of various commodities.
Yeah, but on the same hand, if there's any strategic sense in taking over Taiwan, it's to prevent Taiwan doing anything to restrict China's access, because they're very paranoid about maintaining their sea access to the Pacific, which goes through Taiwan and past Japan. And that is some strategic justification, if you like, for taking action against Taiwan. But I think the greater problem is what happened in Ukraine, where there was absolutely no sense in invading Ukraine. It happened because Russia now has a dictator, Vladimir Putin, who wanted to, and he decided. Xi Jinping is, I hope, not as crazy as Putin is, but he has also regained that one-person power that Mao Zedong once had by effectively getting rid of the collective leadership that came about after Mao Zedong to make sure that no dictator could ever cause such misery and anxiety. He's made himself effectively emperor for life, or Mao Zedong for life. Mm. So should he decide it's in his legacy, he can actually make that strategically disastrous decision and make it happen. This is the problem of living in a world with strongmen in Russia, China, and the US now.
It's disturbing and unpleasant. And I want to ask you a bit, perhaps another day, about Russia, because I know you've got some extraordinary stories from that. But I just want to finish by asking, what was the fallout like from your story about the cultural practice that involved lifting weights with your genitals? When you came back and that aired on Foreign Correspondent, what was the response to that like?
It's the only time as a journalist where I've been part of water cooler conversation around the country. I've done all these very worthy geopolitical stories that have just flown off into the ether, never to be thought of again. But this one, I seem to have, you know, got the pub talk. And that makes me proud. Not since I worked on A Current Affair many years ago have I had that experience of being an Aussie bloke on TV, just telling it like it is.
It's quite a piece of footage, and you're very brave for having done it. I know you've done braver things, but...
If you want to try it after this, Matt, we can, you know, I can show you how to attach it. So
I don't think I have any weights around. Okay. The sash looked very specific. I mean, it looked like a very specific thing that you can only get from that guy.
And if I can just add one last thing, as I was leaving, the man said, look, we have a version for women too, if you're interested. And that's when I thought, no, thank you. I'm going back to lying my bed.
It's odd in the 20 years that it hasn't taken off in popularity around the world. There isn't any branch in Australia that we could pop down to.
Having done it, it makes perfect sense to me. No, don't do it. Don't do it.
Eric, thank you so much for giving us your time today.
Thank you.
If you'd like to watch Eric's reporting for yourself, including his piece on Yin Diao Gong, you'll find links to the stories we mentioned in the show notes. They're great. I highly recommend giving them a watch. This Thursday's episode will be all about Donald Trump's UFC Freedom 250 event. While cage fighting on the White House lawn might seem like an unusual collision of sport and politics, Donald Trump and the UFC have actually been intertwined for decades in an unexpected way. Our next episode tells the story of how mixed martial arts became the MAGA movement's favourite sport. I'll catch you then.